Yasminidam yatascedam yenedam cha imam swayam yasmat parasmat cha para tang prapadye swayam bhuvam. We salute that divine being who is the self of the universe, from whom all things have come, in whom they rest, and whom they control, and who controls them from without and from within, but who remains far beyond both in and out the laws of cause and effect. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhetamastu Ma Vindishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being may the divine beings may we have the strength and skill may no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. The chorus sounds weak this morning. What's the matter? What? Contemplative this morning? Some important voices are missing. I'm having trouble with my throat, which air conditioning. Is everybody cool enough? Air conditioning does it to me. We take up this morning the 11th chapter or division in the series Sages of the Upanishads. If you remember last time, if you hope most of you were here, last time we were talking about the great sage Yajnavalkya. I had his name on the board, I forgot to write it again. It's a hard name, but it's pronounced Yajnavalkya. And he was probably the most important of all the Vedic sages, the Upanishadic sages, because there's more known about him, more said about him, we hear more about him than we do about any of the others. He has a lot to tell us, a great deal to tell us. And last time we had this series, we had a lot of instruction from Yajnavalkya, and today he has a great deal more to tell us. And I want to review just a little bit for those of you who might not have been here on the last one. We wound up with a woman sage. Her name is Gargi, and we have recently lost our important author in the movement, Mary Louise Burke, who was given sannyasa with the name Gargi in honor of this sage. I'm wondering about her self-confidence. If anybody should have thought that she was in there by courtesy, if somebody was paying lip service to the opposite gender, they should take notice of the way in which she asks her questions. She says to him, to Yajnavalkya, who is being questioned by the other sages, you remember? She says, I shall ask him two questions. If he answers me these, None of you can defeat him in arguments about Brahman. Now, what does that mean? That means my two questions are the wisest. And I have no doubt that I'm a superior challenger of this great thinker. So her self-confidence is remarkable, and it makes us quite sure that men and women were on an equal basis at that period in the history of the culture. Well, today, I guess I'm going to have to put my glasses on. I'm going to have to read some things. Today we have chapter 3 of the Brihadaranyaka, the Great Forest Upanishad, and it continues Yajnavalkya's wisdom. The next sage to challenge him is called Shakalya. And Shakalya and Yajnavalkya have a long dialogue. It takes up pages. And so Shakalya questions the sage with this interesting question. How many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? How many gods are there? He answered in accordance with the following invocation from the scriptures, Vedic chants: as many as are mentioned in the hymn of praise to the Vishwadevas, namely 303 and 3003. No wonder the Christians call them polytheistic. It sounds, you see, if you only read a little bit of scripture, you read one scripture, you pick up some book and read a little bit, it sounds as if Hinduism were polytheistic. But just wait. Yes, said Shakalya. But how many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? Six, says Yajnavalkya. Came down very fast. Way down, very fast. Six, said he. Yes, says Shakalya. But how many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? Three, says he. And of course the answer is yes, but how many are there? Two. Yes, says Shakalya. But how many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? One and a half. You don't get him down easily. One and a half. When he's pressed, he says one and a half. The explanation is given in another verse, not this verse, a later verse. The gods are fond of jokes. The gods are fond of puns, especially fond of puns. And so, in the serious, highly abstruse dialectic of the Upanishadic passages, we find these humorous touches which make it so much lighter and so much more interesting. And of course that's not good enough for Shakalya. So he says, how many gods are there, Yajnavalkya? One. See, they don't read far enough. If they got to hear this point, they wouldn't talk about polytheism. One. Yes, said Shakalya, but which are those 303 and 3003? Why, in other words, if there is only one God, why do the verses of the Rig Veda and the other Vedic passages of the ritual talk about 303 and 3003? Why? And here we get the answer. They are but manifestations. Now, in this, we have the whole philosophy of Vedanta, the whole philosophy which is behind all of the aspects of Hinduism, all the ramifications, the sects and divisions. There is but one being, one God of the universe, but because there is a creation, at least in our minds, there is a creation. In our vision, there is a universe, our ignorant vision. We call these the manifestations, the playing out of that one God's power. And then Yajnavalkya lists 33 primal manifestations of the power of Brahman. We call this one God, Brahman. And when he lists these manifestations, he calls them gods with a small g. I can only compare it in the Abrahamic faiths to the angels. Angels are considered in those three faiths, the Bible faiths, they're considered powers or outflowings of God, his messengers, his performers of special tasks. Angels are sent to Jacob. Angels are sent in the Old Testament to many, on many occasions. God doesn't go and do the thing himself. He sends angels. So, if you can think of it in that way, you will understand what is meant by these manifestations being called gods. Human beings like to personify. We can understand things better if we personify, if we anthropomorphize. So, here, I'm not going to read all three of them. I mean 33. Sorry, all 33 of them. But these are not like the gods we know later. Now, I have to explain that when we come to the Bhagavata religion, the religion of the scripture called the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Puranic religion, the religion which comes to us in the Middle Ages, 1300, 1400, 1500, long in there, the Puranas were written. And these Puranas are old, like old novels. One of my teachers used to call them Hinduism's religious novels. They present a new kind of religion, a religion of extreme devotion. This is where Sri Krishna begins, the religion of Krishna and the gopis and all of the stories of Vrindavan and the early life of Krishna and then later the Mathura part of his life. All of this is called the Bhagavata religion. And in that religion, and before it, we get the names of Indra, Varuna, Shiva, Durga, Kali, all of these, Krishna, Rama, these names come up. That's not what we're talking about at this period of the culture, of the religion. Here we're talking about gods who don't have names like that, most of them, and we'll see who they are now. They are nature's forces. The forces of nature, fire, air, sun, moon, the stars, so on. And then we come to the different classes of them. He puts them into different classes, and I'm not going to read all of those, because they won't mean much to us, and they're not scientific, and you won't recognize them as anything that you can give credit to, really. But what I have to explain to you is that these gods, these Vedic gods, you could just define a Vedic god as the consciousness associated with one of these natural forces. Think about this, that our definition of Brahman is, if we have to give one, being, consciousness, bliss. And so, taking just the chit aspect, the consciousness aspect, we can say that with every one of these natural forces, fire, the forms of energy, light, heat, wind, and so on, with each of these, there is a consciousness associated. They cannot exist unless they are founded on and rest upon consciousness. And that consciousness is the consciousness of Brahman. But when that consciousness has been delimited, given a restriction, parenthesis put around it, we can say, in the form of fire, or lightning, or the stars, or the sun, that consciousness gets a new name. And so are the Vedic gods of which we are speaking today. Yajnavalkya is telling us that each of these forces of nature, who have got Sanskrit names by this time, Vasus, Adityas, and so on, these are not the later gods, as I said. They are called Adityas and Vasus and Prajapati and so on. These are the names. So then they get this name, but we must never get the idea that these are physical, purely physical forces, and that they are inert, and that behind them nothing behind them in the way of awareness, of consciousness. And so the consciousness associated with one of these forces is the definition of a god designated as such. We have to remember they are never out there. See, I don't think in the Abrahamic faith there's any conception of an angel being inside of us. The angels are out there, up in heaven, or somewhere invisible, their abode. These gods have never been conceived as being apart from the human organism. If there is a god of fire who rules over the force of the consciousness limited to that energy which kindles the fire on the hearth for the sacrifice, that same god, that same fraction of energy, resides here in my belly as the fire of digestion. You understand? That there's always that parallel. There's something in the microcosm which is the parallel or reflection of that which we see in the macrocosm. So if there is a fire, if there is a force which makes fire on the hearth and kindles and accepts the food we offer, and then there's food left over or cooked by the fire, then that food becomes prasad and is digested by the fire of digestion in me. This is what we're saying in our prayer at puja time, Om Brahmarpanam Brahmahave. Brahmagno Brahmanahutam Brahmaiva Tena Gantavyam Brahma Karma Samadhina. He will attain to Brahman who sees this one power throughout the entire universe in all the activities of the world. Because that one power is felt inside of us as fire and on the hearth as fire. So this is what it's all about. Each of them, these gods, has its locus, dwelling in the bodies of all beings. For example, he who dwells in the sun is he who dwells in the human eye. You see the parallel. Without eye, we cannot see the sun. Without sunlight, we cannot see. So with he who dwells in the sun dwells also in the human eye. All of the answers are going to be like that. Yajnavalkya is going to go on like that. I wanted to explain it before we actually read it. And so now we're going to get personally acquainted with some of these Vedic gods. Verily, he who knows that person whose abode is the earth, whose world is the fire, whose light is the mind, who is the ultimate support of every soul, he verily would be a knower, O Yajnavalkya. This is what Shakalya says. Verily, I know that person, says Yajnavalkya. He has more self-confidence even than Gargi, and he's determined to get those cows, you know. He's working for the 1,000 cows with gold coins on their horns. Some of you weren't here. The prize for the winning of this discussion is 1,000 cows with gold coins tied to the horns of each one. So Yajnavalkya says, I know that person who is the ultimate support of every soul of whom you speak. This very person who is made of desire is he. Now, how is Yajnavalkya going to teach us? It's a setup, you could say. He's going to teach us by countering every one of Shakalya's propositions. He's going to come on to it and supervene, tell him something even more than what's said in the sentence. So Yajnavalkya says, this very person who is made of desire is that support of all souls. Tell me, Shakalya, who is his God? Women, says he. Yes, that's what it says. Women. Women are the God of the power of desire in the man. Verily, he who knows that person whose abode is forms, whose world is the eye, whose light is the mind, same sentence, who is the ultimate support of every soul, he verily would be a knower, O Yajnavalkya. That's a challenge, you see. I know. Yajnavalkya says, verily, I know that person who is the ultimate support of every soul of whom you speak. This very person who is in the sun is he. Tell me, Shakalya, who is his God? And that the answer to that is truth. Now, I cannot easily explain to you, maybe some of you will have a suggestion, why the matchup between the sun and the eye, the macrocosm and the macrocosm, why that the God of that pair is called truth. Anybody got suggestions? Well, think about it. Maybe, yes?
Maybe there's drawing a parallel between truth and light, as in enlightenment.
Ha! Huh. There's a suggestion. Enlightenment. Ah, yeah. Very good. Thank you. Yeah. Probably the idea of enlightenment was associated with the light, and the sun and the eye, because what we get when we're enlightened is a new vision, a new view of the world. I hadn't thought that out that much. It's good. Then 13, in the same setup, I know that person, I know who. Well, this time it's whose world is the ear, who is the ultimate soul of every soul, whose abode is space. Now here there was an intuitive understanding of the connection between the semicircular canals which give us direction, that they were behind the ear is coincidental, probably, except that the ear receives sound. But the connection here is being made between the ear and the quarters of space, the directions of space. And he says, verily I know that person who is, oh, this very person who is in hearing and who is in the echo is he. Tell me, Shakarya, who is his God? The quarters of space, north, south, east, and west. You see, there's an intuitive grasp of the connection between echo, sound, space. We would analyze it according to the laws of physics. Here was an intuitive, pre-scientific, subjective analysis of the relationship between distance, sound, the time it takes for echo, and the relationship to direction, how they used to find directions by sending out sound to have it echo back. If you know the culture of the Native Americans, you can understand this, all of this, a little bit more easily. Well, 14. So the answer here was the quarters of space. That's the God for that function. Verily, he who knows that person whose abode is darkness, whose world is the heart, whose light is the mind, who is the ultimate support of every soul, he verily would be a knower, O Yajnavalkya. Verily, I know that person who is the ultimate support of every soul and of whom you speak. This very person who is made of shadow is he. Tell me, Shakalya, who is his God? Anybody want to guess? Huh? No, it's death. Now, this is probably the most psychologically significant for us. The world is called darkness, and the person who is made of shadow, and this God is made of shadow and darkness, and the name of this God is death. We can't conceive of a time when human beings were not frightfully leery of death, very much afraid of death, how they saw it as the end and so on. This part of the Upanishads probably predates the development of the theory of karma and reincarnation. We think that the development of a full doctrine of karma and reincarnation came after this ancient Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka. So in those days, what happened at death was just about anybody's guess, and except for those who had attained enlightenment, and there were some. So he says this God's name is death, and he is associated with a world of darkness where senses shut down, the mind, even the light of the mind, just becomes dark, and is shadow. Shadow is covers the earth. Shadow covers the life of the human being. And when they saw the eclipses and other kinds of shadows in the form of storms and so on, there was a lot of fear involved in it. Well, let's go to number 15. He who knows that person whose abode is forms, whose world is the eye, whose light is the mind, who is the ultimate support of every soul, he verily would be a knower, O Yajnavalkya. Forms is the operative word here, whose world is the eye. Verily I know that person who is the ultimate support of every soul and of whom you speak. This very person who is in the looking glass is he. Tell me, Shakyamuni, who is his God? Life, says Shakyamuni. We see this world of forms and names. The forms belong to the eye. The eye doesn't give names. The mind gives names. So this is the God of external forms. His abode is the things which we configure, with which we configure the universe. The forms. How are they perceived? Well, of course, by touch too and by sound. But in the Upanishads, the eye is often used to stand for all the other senses. So we see this world of forms, we experience it primarily with the eye. And who is that person? What is that God which puts these together, forms and the eye? And that person is the one in the mirror. It's you. It's me. And his name is Life. A living person looking in the mirror sees the God of the world of forms and the eye. It is this gross body, life in the gross form, in the human body, is the projector of the Maya which covers the face of Brahman. Brahman, the truth or reality, is covered by a veil of Maya or avidya, ignorance, consisting of the division of truth into broken up pieces like a jigsaw puzzle. And that jigsaw puzzle is called life, and that life is seen by an individual when he looks in the mirror. Oh yes, they had mirrors. They had probably made of metal. Well, the next one, I'm not going to go through them all. Let's go to 24. Number 20. There are 26, and I'm only reading some of them. 24 is an interesting one. Or 23, I guess it has to start with 23. Well, Shakyamuni asks him, on what is the heart supported? Because everything comes back to the heart. A lot of things have come back to the heart here. And he says, on what is the heart supported? Yajnavalkya says, on the heart, for through the heart one knows truth. Therefore, it is on the heart that the truth is supported. You could say that's where enlightenment comes in the heart. Even so, Yajnavalkya, Shakyamuni agrees with him this time. What deity have you fixed? What deity have you in this fixed quarter, zenith? The deity fire. On what is fire supported? On speech. I can't understand, I can't explain these to you. On what is fire supported? On speech. Well, I guess energy. On what is speech supported? On the heart. On what is the heart supported? These people don't wait until they get to the bottom of things, do they? On what is the heart supported? And Yajnavalkya says, "You ghost." That's what he said. He calls him a ghost. "You ghost, that you think that it, the heart, would be anywhere else than in ourselves. For if it were anywhere else than in ourselves, the dogs would eat it and the birds would pick at it and tear it to pieces." The lesson here in this verse is, don't ever think that anything in the universe, whatever you may call it, however it may seem like a last term, is outside this. This is the source of everything. What is in this individual is in the universe. What's in the universe is in this individual. Here is the key to everything. Here is the source, the life, the heart, the eye, the fire, the everything is here in this individual being, which we can look at in the mirror. You're a ghost if you think that the heart would be established or supported on anything but the individual human being. It's not out there for the dogs. Oh, by the way, somebody's heart was... Whose was it?
Louis XVII.
His heart was preserved after his body was destroyed. Well, how did they kill and take care of the body?
He died. He was in prison.
He died.
He died at
10. Yeah, and somebody rescued the heart. Now it looks like a dried apricot. But that's not the kind of... That's not the kind of heart that... They still have it, and it looks like a dried apricot. That's not the kind of heart we're talking about. That kind of heart the dogs could eat and the birds tear to pieces, but not the heart, that's not the real heart. So it's really a beautiful answer. I'm going to read his final answer, because it really is very beautiful. He explains why he calls him a ghost. And just listen to this. Shakalya, pushing on, says, "On what are you and yourself supported?" Yajnavalkya said, "On the prana, energy. On what is prana supported?" And he goes through the list of pranas. And they were supported one on the other. And finally, on what is the samana, the final breath, supported? On the self, with a capital S. That self is not this, not this, not that. It is incomprehensible, for it is never comprehended. It is indestructible, for it cannot be destroyed. It is unattached, for it does not attach itself. It is unfettered. It does not suffer. It is not injured. These are the eight abodes, the eight worlds, the eight gods, the eight persons. He who takes apart and puts together these persons and passes beyond them, that is the person taught in the Upanishads, about whom I ask you. If you do not explain him to me, your head will fall off." Like before, once before we had that. Somebody's head would fall off if he didn't know. Gargi's head.
Friends, what number was that?
This is verse 26. I'm going to read that again because it's so nice. And what he means by the eight abodes and all that, that isn't explained, but we could say they are the eight steps of Patanjali's eight steps of yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, or we could say it's Buddha's eightfold path. There are obviously a series of eight things which you have to transcend before you get to that full experience. Let me read it again. This self is nathi, nathi, not this, not that. It is incomprehensible, for it is not comprehended. Nothing. How could anything comprehend it? It means encompass it. It is indestructible, for it is never destroyed. It is unattached, for it does not attach itself. It is unfettered, it does not suffer. It is not injured. These are the eight abodes, the eight worlds, the eight gods, the eight persons. He who takes apart and puts together these persons, which he has just done for us, you see, taught in these Upanishads, about whom I ask you, and passes beyond them. That is the person taught in these Upanishads, about whom I ask you. If you do not explain him to me, your head will fall off. And I'm sorry to say, folks, the story has a very horrible ending. Shakalyas did not know him, and his head fell off, and robbers took away his bones, thinking they were something else. That's what it says. I'm sorry. I'm not going to clean it up for you. I don't intend to do that. Yeah, I guess the bare bones were left and robbers took them away. But I don't know what for. Probably to do rituals.
But what's the significance of head falling off?
We talked about this on the previous occasion. It makes a good story and it makes something fun to memorize. For the students, you know, the students have to have a little juice in their lessons. So there's a little bit of funny story in the juicy story in there. And they learn it. Makes it easier to learn. I suppose the esoteric meaning is if you don't know this, that means you are ignorant. And one day, whether in this body or in the next or another body, one day you will attain enlightenment. And when you attain enlightenment, your whole body will drop off, not just the head. You will lose consciousness of this gross human body. When the experience of enlightenment comes, you will lose body consciousness. I hope that's what it meant. I hope that was the esoteric meaning of it. That one day, since you're not knowing it now, your head hasn't dropped yet, but one day your head will fall off. All right, we go on to Then Yajnavalkya said, after Shakalya's head had fallen off, "Venerable Brahmins," a company of contestants, you know, for the cows. "Venerable Brahmins, whosoever amongst you wishes to do so may question me, or you may all question me, or I will question him of you who wishes to be questioned, or I will question all of you." Wow. What a boast. He really wants those cows. He's determined to get those cows. You can ask me, one of you can ask, choose one to ask me, or you can all ask me, or I will ask one of you or all of you. So look out. Those Brahmins did not dare to say anything. See, you see why I call him the greatest sage. He has taken the contest, he's taken the prize, he's conquered them all. None of them now dare to question him. So obviously he was a knower of God and an enlightened soul, a knower of Brahman. But now instead of question and answer session taking place, Yajnavalkya gives us a little sermon in the form of a parable, an analogy. And I'm going to read that. And when you hear it, I think you will recognize that there must have been some dissection in that culture. See, the human body was regarded as the abode of Brahman, as all human body was regarded as sacred. And that's why generally they didn't abandon them. They always burned. So far as we know, they always burned them. And so I don't know whether a dissection of a corpse had taken place, but I think so from the little parable he gives here. It's all in poetry, in Sanskrit type of poetry. I'll read a verse or two of it, just so you get the rhythm. Yata vriksho vanaspati tatayva purusho mrsha tasya lomani parnani tog asyotpatika bahi tvaccha evasya rudhiram prasyandi tvaccha utpataha tasmat tad atrinat paiti raso vrikshad ivalahat. As is a mighty tree, so indeed is a human being. His hairs are leaves, and his skin is its outer bark. They were utterly familiar with the anatomy of a tree, no question about that. That part of it is quite accurate and scientific. And we have doubts about the other. Anyway. His hairs are leaves, and his skin is its outer bark. From his skin, blood flows forth, and sap from the skin of the tree. Therefore, when a man is wounded, blood flows as sap from a tree that is struck. His flesh is its inner bark. His nerves are tough like inner fibers. His bones are the wood within, and the marrow is made resembling pith. The pith of the tree, marrow of the bones. The, what do you call it, the wood, what kind of wood is that called? Well, the main wood of the tree is his bones. A tree, when it is felled, springs up from its root in a newer form. Right? From what root does man spring forth when he is cut off by death? Do not say, from the semen, for that is produced from what is alive. A tree springs up also from the seed. After it is dead, it certainly springs again. In the seed form. If a tree is pulled up by the root, however, it will not spring again. From what root does a mortal spring forth when he is cut off by death? You know where he's going. When born, he is not born again, for who should create him again? Brahman, who is knowledge, bliss is the final goal of him who offers gifts, as well as of him who stands firm and knows. The implication, the commentators give implication here. There is rebirth for a human being, just as there is for a tree, unless the tree is pulled up by the root. If the tree is pulled up by the root, it will not produce another tree. If the human being is pulled up by the root, the root of ignorance is pulled out. He is not born again. Who would create him again? Brahman is knowledge. Bliss is the final goal. Now, get the subtlety of this. Bliss is the final goal of him who offers gifts, cows, as well as of him who stands firm and knows. So Yajnavalkya and the cows are both here in the final equation. I love it. That's the clear implication of it. Brahman, or bliss, is the final goal of the king who is offering the gifts, as well as him who stands firm and knows. You know that old story, and the freshman is one who knows not, and knows not that he knows not. The sophomore is one who knows not, and knows that he knows not. The junior is one who knows and knows not that he knows, but the senior knows and he knows that he knows.
Swamiji, Rumsfeld should be reminded of that.
Huh?
Rumsfeld should be reminded of that.
Now let's keep politics out of this. Let's keep politics out of it. Compare it with Buddha's exaltation when he gets to nirvana. You remember he turns and he addresses Mara, the great tempter. Mara, the equivalent, Buddhist equivalent of Maya. He says, "Oh, thou cunning hider, never again will you erect this tent. Never again will you put up its roof pole and its timbers. I have found you at last. I've caught you. Never again will this body be reconstructed." And he exalts and exalts over that experience. Well, let's see, we have a little time. I think I'll just start the next part of the lesson of Yajnavalkya. We won't go into it in depth, we won't have time. But there's another audience. He has another audience with King Janaka. Janaka and Yajnavalkya are the co-conspirators of this kind of knowledge. And they have a number of sessions together, in episodic interviews, and this is another one. And just to begin it for us. Janaka, king of Videha, was seated to give audience. Yajnavalkya came in. Strange. Then he, Janaka, said to him, "Yajnavalkya, for what purpose have you come today? For cattle or for subtle questions?" What do you think Yajnavalkya says? Huh?
Both.
Both, my lord. He says, "Both, your majesty." Yes, he is quite a worldly, enlightened being. Yes, I come for both. And but he comes not wanting to talk. He's not in a mood to talk this time. And so he says to Janaka, because Janaka is a very educated, spiritually educated king. He becomes in the end a Rajarshi. You know, we've talked about him before. He becomes known as a Rajarshi, a king sage, royal sage, because he's so learned and has so much spiritual wisdom. But at this stage, he's still in the learning process. And Yajnavalkya says to him, let me hear what any of your teachers may have told you. And of course, I will ace him. I will, what do you call it in bridge?
Trump.
Trump. I will trump his answer. Thank you. And you're okay. I will trump him. And what he does is to ask him about all kinds of things. And I'm going to go to finish it up to the one. Janaka, when he gives a good answer, Janaka says to him, I will give you 1,000 cows with a bull as large as an elephant. And Yajnavalkya says, my father thought that no one should accept gifts without having instructed. They're Brahmins. That's their life work. Brahmins, that's their what they're supposed to do. A Yajnavalkya, is he a Brahmin? I forget.
He's a Kshatriya.
He's not a Kshatriya. He's a Kshatriya. So he isn't, but he has this same ethic. Don't accept gifts without imparting your knowledge. Yes. All right. Then we'll come to the most important one. He says, Janaka asks Yajnavalkya. Finally, Yajnavalkya decides to answer. Where is that? Yes, in the third one. What light is there for a human being? What serves as light for a man? And Yajnavalkya says, the sun serves as light for a human being. And Janaka says, and when the sun has set, what is light for a human being? The moon, oh, Janaka, the moon is the light for a man. Ah, and when the moon has gone down or has covered, what is light for a man? Fire is his light, because in that culture they kindled fires. At night there were many fires were lit, and they worked or traveled with burning torches, the light of fire. So he says, fire is the light for a man. And when the fire has gone out, Yajnavalkya, what serves as light for a man? And what do you think he says? Do you remember? I've told this before.
The mind.
Huh?
Speech.
Speech serves as light for a man. For by sound, by the sound of a person's voice, one can move around, go out, even work, and come back. And when sound is silent, Yajnavalkya says, what is light for a man? Oh, Janaka, when the sun has gone down and the moon is covered and stars are not there and fire is put out and sound is silent, then the Atman is the light for a man. You said mind, but he says Atman, one's own inner light. The ultimate light of the whole universe is our own inner light. It's by our own inner intelligence, intuition, whatever you want to call it, which comes from our true self, that we can go out even in the dark and grope our way or intuitively sense the direction in which to move, to go to a place. We have to go by our Atman, which inspires our intellect, yes, our mind and intellect. That's the ultimate light for a man. And That's the most important part of this particular dialogue. So, if you have any comments or questions, this is the time. It was a difficult class today. It was a difficult lesson. I had a lot of work to do on it myself. I hope that we have made some meaning out of it, right. At least about the gods.
Swami?
Yeah.
Certainly, excellent meaning came out of it.
Pardon?
Excellent meaning came out of it in the end, and the observation that I had was that all along it sounds as if Yajnavalkya is showing his ego,
yeah,
going for the prize, and really, really feeling it very important till the end when he compares that prize to the other ultimate.
Yeah, that's a good observation.
One realizes that it was not ego, it was just that ultimate prize, not the cause, that he really meaning to get.
That's one of the differences. That's good. That's one of the differences between Zen, the Zen form of Buddhism, and Vedanta. They're often compared, but in Zen, the ego is either abandoned or squashed, usually. And in Vedanta, we see the need for the ego to keep on working until it unravels itself. See what I'm saying? The ego has to keep on giving answers and tearing them down. It's the ego which has to aspire for the next stage, to go to the next degree, the next advance. And like a ball of yarn, it works to unravel itself. And ultimately it disappears, but it has to keep doing the spiritual struggle. Without the ego, we can't go on struggling, we can't go on striving and trying to reach higher truth. So we employ the ego to evaporate the ego. That's what you could say. That's the idea. Yes?
I've tried to understand the meaning of this explanation of Brahman,
a little louder, please.
Not this. What does it lead us to? At least it tells us that our assumptions are wrong if we think this is Brahman or that is Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we have to realize that the body is not Atman, we are not our body, not mind. Whatever we think we could identify ourselves with is not our own self.
That's it.
And by elimination, if we see that all things which we could mistakenly assume to be ourselves are not, then maybe we can come close to that realization, which is enlightenment.
See, but you see, there are two things are at work, though. The picture we get just now I gave you is a picture of picking at. One of the Upanishads likens it to a bird trying to empty the ocean, billful at a time. If that discourages you, don't read that passage. But and so this picking at the, and constantly having the wrong thing come and identify, and this comes up, you identify with that. No, not this. Another one comes, no, not this. And it goes on and on and on for the whole of your life, or life after life, whatever. The antidote to that is what we're having on Thursday night, you know, at the class. Shankara says, in the twinkling of an eye, the moment that the mind realizes the falsity of the relative and the truth of the absolute, he becomes one with it. Everything falls down at once. Ignorance, together with all of its concomitants, is cut at the root in that final experience. And that can come at any time, for anyone, under any circumstances, if the time is right. Any other questions?
In other words, the ego will continue to work its way until that moment when everything drops out.
Because ego itself is not real, it is insubstantial. And once you discover its insubstantiality, there's no more work to do. Yet you have to work with it so long as it's real for you. So long as it's real for you, you have to work for it. When you discover that it's not real, you're there. Well,
Swami,
yeah?
Would this sage be considered enlightened or near enlightened?
Pardon?
This sage in the passage, would he be considered enlightened or near enlightened?
You got to be one to know one. He asks me as if I know. You know? I didn't get caught in your trap.
Very wise, and yeah, so I yeah. wonder if that means that he knows any question.
There's never been any, I was being funny, but there's never been any question that he was a knower. That has always been the assumption. Anyone who could give that description of the self, these verses are the source of Vedanta. Vedanta is built on these verses, built on the assumption that these people knew what they were talking about.
Right.
So, don't ask me.
I would also say that it also brings out the point that enlightened people just not just retire away from life. They still engage in life and look at it in a different perspective and be very, very active.
That's right. It shows that he doesn't have to come from a cave and come out and say, this is what I have found in my loneliness.
And I'm going to go away.
You know, no, right? He comes out and gets cows. That is characteristic of the Vedic culture. They were karma yogis. They were yogis who were involved in the world and had jobs to do and things to get. And then you know, oh yes, you remember we had the dialogue between him and his wife, Maitreyi. Were you here for that? Well, you know about it. He says, "I'm now going to go off and renounce the world." So he apparently was a knower of God before he had his sannyasa, but now he's going to fulfill the traditional monk's vow and go out and become a sannyasa. So he does that. At the end, in that particular chapter. Yeah. He was apparently a householder who was a knower of Brahman. And then, in true conformity with the tradition of the times, he ended his life by abandoning his home and possessions, and he left all his wealth to Maitreyi and Katyayani, and he went out. Any more? What time is up?